Good morning. I'm going to call the Agriculture and Food Finance and Policy Division to order so everybody can take their seats. We have a full agenda today. We want to make sure that we get through everything and try to get everybody who wanted to be able to testify to be able to do that. We obviously have a first committee deadline coming up on Friday, so we're going to today talk about the DE amendment for the policy bill, and then if you have amendments, those would be need to be prepared by tomorrow morning at 9:45. So we have them and are able to post those, and then we will have that bill do the final markup of that bill on Friday or on Thursday and be able to hopefully pass it out of committee. So I'm going to we have March 7th, 2019 meeting minutes in the packets, and Representative Brand.
Yes, Madam Chair. I move the minutes from the last meeting on March 7th.
Thank you. So there's a motion to approve the minutes for March 7th, 2019. Any additions or corrections? All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. And so we have a couple of bills right off the bat here. We have Representative Sundin has the bioincentive program House File 1595. So we're going to bring Representative Sundin to the table here. Welcome to the division. So it's my intention to lay this bill over for possible inclusion.
And thank you, Madam Chair.
I will move House File 1595 to get the bill before us. So, Representative Sundin, please tell us about your bill.
I'll do the best I can. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. We have Sappy Fine Paper up in Cloquet, Minnesota that does a tremendous job utilizing all the wood fiber that comes into their plant. They actually have a variety of products that come out of that plant. One is, of course, paper, and the second one is a cellulose product that is mainly for export to foreign countries, and a lot of that comes back in the form of clothing, medical supplies, that type of thing. It's just amazing the work that they do. I do have a testifier somewhere, okay, that I've yet to meet. The next step is actually a sweetener product that is derived from the sap of primarily a popple tree. And to better explain the bill, we do have an industry expert.
Okay, welcome to the committee, Mr. Jordan. If you'd introduce yourself, provide testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Brendan Jordan with the Great Plains Institute, and I represent the Bioeconomy Coalition of Minnesota. This is a broad partnership, including the forest products industry, agriculture, and a variety of both established and startup industries. The Bioeconomy Coalition is very supportive of the bioincentive program. It's a program that is supporting a variety of projects around the state, including bio-based chemical production, advanced biofuels, and biomass thermal energy. The project at SAPI is one of several projects that the program will support. This program has proved to be a very useful tool for entities in the state that do economic development, try to attract new projects using, again, agricultural, forestry, and organic waste raw materials, add value and add economic impact and jobs. As the program has been in place since 2015, it has attracted more attention. There are more companies in the pipeline, so to speak. And, you know, we expect the program to expand over time. It is a performance-based program that only offers an incentive for production. So there's no upfront money from the state. We kind of refer to it as a boondoggle-proof program. There just is no upfront money. So unless you get the jobs and economic impact, the state does not pay. Bioeconomy Coalition is very supportive of this bill, and happy to answer any questions, but.
All right, thank you. Any questions from Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
to the testifier, a good program administered by the Department of Ag, does DEED play any part in awarding these grants?
Mr. Jordan.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, the state agencies do collaborate in using the program to recruit new companies, but I wouldn't say that DEED has a role in administering necessarily, but they do collaborate pretty closely with the Department of Agriculture in, you know, letting companies know what's available to them if they want to consider an expansion or a new project in the state.
All right. Any other questions from committee members? Is there anyone else that would want to testify on House File 1595? I see none. Do you have any other comments, Representative Sundin?
Certainly, the Sappy Fine Paper plant in Cloquet, Minnesota employs about 700 people thereabouts, and it's a very clean plant, and this will allow for a little more diversification of their end products, and ask for your support.
Thank you. All right, so I see no other questions, and thank you for that. We're going to just lay this over for future consideration. So thank you, Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee.
I'm trying to look for Representative Backer. I'm not sure if he's in the audience. He's got the next bill up. And after that. You know what? I think we'll go to Representative Hansen. Has House File 1908. He is here, so we're able to actually move that. So it's going to be House File 1908 in your packets. All right, Representative Hansen. As with the others, it's my intention to lay this bill over for possible inclusion. I know that this appears to be a policy bill, but there is a fiscal note that was requested, and so I know you'll speak to that as well. But if you want to go ahead and move your bill and begin.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I would move House File 1908 for possible inclusion in the omnibus agricultural finance bill.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. So go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. House File 1908 is a bill that restores language that was passed, I believe, in 2014, it may have been 2013, and was law for a couple of years. Then it was changed again in 2015. And it's a relatively short bill. I want to walk through what the bill is and isn't. This is a bill relating to labeling of nursery stock. So pollinator-friendly materials have become very popular with the general public and are sought out when people are looking to purchase plants for their yards, for their gardens, etc. And so there were some news articles of research that have been done back in that time of 13 and 14 where plant materials that were being labeled as being pollinator-friendly actually were not, that they were having a presence of neonicotinoid or other systemic pesticides that would render them not pollinator-friendly. So this is a truth in labeling bill to say that you could not, that a person who is providing that plant material could not label something or advertise it as being pollinator-friendly if it is not. Where the controversy has come in over the years and been changed, the law was changed from the original bill, is how do you determine whether it's pollinator-friendly? What is the enforceable level? And what this bill does is puts the bill back, the law back to the way it was when it was passed. The changes are on the second page. And, you know, I know there will be folks that testify. I think it's important to note that your plant materials come from a variety of sources. You have wholesalers, you have retailers, you have mom-and-pop operations. You may have flats of plants that are growing in an international economy that are started somewhere and then shipped here, and the retailer buys them from a wholesaler, and they may be treated with a pesticide that is systemic. And what I mean by systemic is it goes through the plant. Maybe it was put on the plant or in the seed or in the material where the plant was started, but the homeowner purchases it. That systemic pesticide could be expressed in the pollen of the flower that it is being attracted to, and it could have an impact on the pollinators that the purchaser is actually buying the plant to try to attract pollinators. I think it's really important. I'm going to start from 2.14 and 2.15, and this is the heart of the change that was made to the law. The no observable adverse effect level means the level established by the U.S. EPA for acute oral toxicity for adult honeybees. We know that there are a large number of pollinators beyond honeybees. Often a honeybee is the symbol. That might be the smiling bee that's put on the advertising. But there are native bees. I think the DNR in a different research area, there are hundreds of native bees, and they be of different sizes. The toxicity levels are not tested on native bees. And the adult honeybee may be different than the larval honeybee. The adult honeybee may be different than a bumblebee and may be different than other pollinators, the rusty patch bumblebee, very small native bees that could be impacted by it. So when we go up to 2.4, this was the original requirement to say that if there was a detectable level of a systemic insecticide in there, that was the enforceable level. Now, I think it's going to be rare that the Department of Ag would be testing a plant for determining whether there is a detectable level. But we want the truth in labeling so that when Minnesotans are purchasing a plant for to be pollinator-friendly, that it actually is pollinator-friendly. And the reason that this will go to the Finance Committee, Madam Chair, the Finance Division, is that it costs to test. And as we have new chemistry, it has costs for the new chemistry. There have been standards that have been developed for water and soil. The test would be done here on the floral material, and it does cost to do that. I think the estimated cost may be somewhere around $30,000 or $40,000 for a testing regime over a biennium. So what the bill does is it deletes the no observed adverse effect level, and it has that reference in 2.8, 2.9, and says that it has a detectable level of a systemic, that is the enforceable option. Now, I hope that retailers who are selling this would be trying to, and I think many large retailers and small retailers and home and garden landscapers have made a marketing decision not to include systemic pesticides in their products. And anyone can do that. It just, what this bill says is you can't label something as being pollinator friendly if it doesn't. The other change is on 2.1, and it's trying to get to the wholesaler as well, that the wholesaler makes sure that the retailer does not get caught by having a product that the wholesaler is selling as being pollinator-friendly where it's not. So that, Madam Chair and members, is the bill.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. And I believe, don't know if you have testifiers. I know there's somebody on the list who wants to testify. So I'm going to bring down either Forrest Sir or Tim Powers, person that was going to, I believe. Okay. So welcome to the committee, and if you will please state your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Tim Power. I'm with the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill. I testified with and had a discussion with Representative Hansen when his original bill was presented, and again when Representative McNamara's bill passed, which made the change to which he referred. MNLA, the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, opposes House File 1908, a bill that would affect the truth in advertising section of the nursery law, Minnesota Statutes Chapter 18H. Our original industry concern in 2014 was that the terms pollinator-friendly, pollinator-attractive, bee-friendly, etc., and the bee or butterfly symbols on labels, plant tags, that had been used to describe have been used to describe plant characteristics without regard to pesticide status. So this was a, in 2014, the change to include pesticide status of a plant as a requirement for labeling was new. We advised our members at the time that the bill passed into law to sanitize, not advertise. And in effect, what that did is we were recommending to our members that they stop providing information about whether plants were attractive to pollinators and provide less information rather than more. As Representative Hansen mentioned, the 2014 law included the term detectable level. And Minnesota Department of Agriculture can now detect chemicals like imidacloprid, the most heavily used neonicotinoid insecticide, down to levels in the low parts per billions. The 2015 statute change that Representative McNamara carried and is now law retained pesticide status as a part of the requirement for plant labeling, but it changed the level from detectable level to NOAEL. And as Representative Hansen mentioned, this is a level that's on the same dose response curve that you where you find LD50 or lethal dose or for 50% of a set of test animals. That is at the very low end where, yes, there's pesticide in the system. No, it is not yet causing observable effects. It was our feeling that the ability to detect something does not indicate that we are seeing an unsafe level. We would like to retain the ability to use neonics, keep it as a tool in the toolbox, even though I would certainly agree with Representative Hansen that with very low LD50s in the parts per billion, rather than parts per million that we see for other insecticides, we would like to retain that. But risk is only part of the equation. Exposure is important also. Many of us heard back in 2013 of the example of 50,000 bumblebees dying in a Target parking lot in Wilsonville, Oregon, due to inappropriate and off-label application of dinotefuran, another neonic, to linden trees while they were in bloom. Well, it was a horrible and illegal misuse of chemicals, and the applicator was fined. Not enough, in my opinion. But the bee box on the new pesticide labels and other changes to pesticide labels have really, I think, improved the legal requirements for an applicator to avoid spraying at certain times, therefore reducing the exposure of potential pollinators in the area to the insecticide in question. Farmers do this all the time. They spray sometimes dangerous chemicals, and they reduce the exposure to themselves by using enclosed cabs and charcoal filters. So we think that the EPA has already gone a long way towards reducing exposure by adding things like the bee box and improvements to the plant label. Finally, Representative Hansen talked about persons selling at retail or providing to an end user being eliminated as a part of House File 1908. Dr. Vera Krishik is an entomologist at the University of Minnesota, and she has highlighted some of the dangers of using neonics in the landscape. And I certainly believe that she is right. I think there are other ways to deal with the problems with neonics, like in, including the possibility of changing neonics to restricted-use pesticides. There are lots of different options to reduce risk and reduce exposure. But we would prefer, as an association, to retain access to these chemicals because there are times when it's really important to have access to that tool. One additional point, my apologies, but large nurseries buy their plant tags from national suppliers, and the national suppliers deal with 50 states rather than one state. Minnesota is the only state that has pesticide status as a determinant as to what kind of a plant tag can be put onto a plant. Those suppliers would much prefer not to have everybody else in one batch and Minnesota in another batch in terms of what kind of plant tags they put forward. Sorry for the rambling on, Madam Chair, and I would be happy to take questions if there are any.
And thank you, Mr. Power. And so I know we have a question. Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tim, it's great to see you again. I have a couple questions for you. One, how does the industry use systemic insecticides in this manner, and why is it necessary? And then second, what is Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association doing to reduce and eliminate the use of neonics in nursery stock?
Mr. Power.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Tabke, nice to see you again as well, and congratulations on your victory. The association itself is providing education. And among those points of education, we are talking about the dangers that go along with the inherent strengths of neonics. One of the beauties of neonics and other systemics is the fact that they can be applied less frequently because the plant will retain the insecticidal qualities. At the same time, as a plant, let's use just the example of seed treatment for corn. It's a relatively potent insecticide that covers the seed, but by the time the plant is exposed to the pest for which the treatment was added, it's much less, a much lower concentration within the plant. Using that same comparison, a tree that has been treated with a foliar applied insecticide for potato leaf hopper, and I'm talking maples or something like that, will retain its toxicity to potato leaf hoppers for 3 or 4 weeks. So a big production company like Bailey's in St. Paul won't have to apply weekly potato leaf hopper treatments at the time when alfalfa is being harvested, and therefore leaf hoppers are spreading everywhere. That's the beauty of the systemics. The addition of the bee box on pesticide labels means that we are constrained from spraying at certain times, like when a plant is in flower, thus reducing the risk. I answered part of your question. I'm not sure I answered both halves.
All right. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think it's really important to note that this is a truth in labeling provision. It does not say you can't use neonicotinoids. It says that any retailer could continue to use that. It just says that you cannot label the plant material as being pollinator-friendly if it's not. All the discussion about pesticides and the detectable level versus the no observed adverse effect level is related to how do you prove that if you were doing an enforcement action. So let's say Mr. Power had a greenhouse and he was selling the material and he's got a big smiling butterfly on the plants, and somebody goes in, I want that big smiling butterfly plant, and he purchases it. Now, he could sell that where it has a systemic insecticide that expresses itself in the floral material and in the pollen. If he doesn't put the butterfly on, he can continue to do that. No big deal. But if you're putting a pollinator-friendly label on it, the test is to look at a detection. And I go again back to 2.14, 2.15, is this is acute oral toxicity for adult honeybees. There are a whole range of other insects that could be affected, that are drawn to that plant, that could be affected by a content that is less than that. So the detectable level is the enforceable level. You go out, he's got the smiling butterfly on the plant. A sample is taken. It comes back with a detectable level of a systemic insecticide in the flowers. Then his violation is in the labeling. It's not a pesticide violation. It is a violation in the labeling. So what we're trying to do here is truth in labeling. Not saying you can't do it. You can continue to use the product, but you can't do the labeling that it's pollinator friendly if it's not.
Thank you. This is a public hearing, so is there anyone from the audience that would like to testify in support or in opposition? Please come forward. Thank you, Mr. Power. And we're going to give you a minute to provide some very fast testimony. Welcome to the committee and state your name, please.
Thank you all so much for having me. My name's Erin Roop. I run an organization called Pollinate Minnesota. I served on Governor Dayton's Pollinator Committee. I was here in 2014, had a pesticide kill at one of my hives, I'll speak a little bit more on that later. But we passed House File 1908 because, folks are interested in planting habitat for pollinators. They want to know that the plants that they're buying are bee-friendly. This concern about bees that folks had in 2014 has not diminished. We saw, 3 pollinator bills that year. There are, I think, over 10 this year. In 2014, there was one community in Minnesota working on a pollinator-friendly resolution for their own municipality. Now we have 40 municipalities who are pollinator-friendly. People want to plant food for bees, and they want to know that those plants are safe. And to the sublethal impact that Representative Hansen mentioned. So in Minnesota, at last count from our U of M bee lab, we have or have had 469 bee species here in our state. That's amazing. Almost everybody is smaller than honeybees, and we don't know that much about their exposure in terms of parts per billion, but the indication is that with the studies that we do have that exposure is less than honeybees can tolerate. Bumblebees are bigger than honeybees, but the exposure to bumblebees in the research is also indicating that that's less.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm going to see if there's any questions. From the committee, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, with the new language in your bill, you're really talking about a zero tolerance level, correct?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, it's actually the old language that's in the bill that was originally passed, and what we're saying is a detectable level. So the analysis that the Department of Agriculture or its contractors would do to see if there is a detection in there. That's the way of proving that there wasn't the systemic pesticide in there.
Representative Anderson.
But Representative, isn't one part per billion a detectable level?
Yeah. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It depends on the chemistry, and we also don't know what is the effect level. Could one part per billion have an impact on a native bee or a powashiek skipperling or something else that's very endangered?
Representative Anderson.
But again, we're talking, and this is a labeling thing, I understand that, but if it has any detectable level with your bill, it wouldn't be labeled as bee-friendly then, correct?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, that's correct, that they could not label it as being pollinator-friendly if it has that detectable level. They could still use product, they can have that, but they wouldn't be able to label it as pollinator-friendly.
Thank you. Any other questions? I know we're pressed for time. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hansen. I just want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think there's growing awareness of neonics, and as people are wanting to plant plants that are bee-friendly, they're assuming that those plants, as they go to the store and they say bee-friendly, that that's not there. And I think we should make sure that consumers aren't having to work so hard to find plants that are actually neonic free. That's a concern that's rising to the top of mind for people in the state.
Thank you. All right, so this bill is going to be laid over for possible inclusion, House File 1908. Thank you, Representative Hansen. And we're going to go to Representative Backer. So back to House File 931. Representative Backer, welcome to the committee. And I think I'll move House File 931 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So, Representative Backer.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I was visiting with some constituents in the office, so I apologize for being tardy. So, the bioincentive program passed in 2015 with very strong bipartisan support. The program provides productive incentives to use a new generation of feedstock to process advanced biofuels, renewable chemicals, and biomass thermal energy. Feedstocks can include plants, plant fibers, wood, wood waste, and even the organic portion of solid waste. When the program was first enacted in 2015, it was impossible to foresee all the technologies that could come about and what could have qualified for this initiative. This bill adjusts the program to incentivize commercial scale traditional corn ethanol facilities to process cellulose biomass while also encouraging small-scale facilities to come into the market as well. So just a couple changes in this bill. What we're doing is if you look in Section 1, we add the word advance to modify the term quarterly biofuel production to conform to other parts of the section pertaining to advanced biofuel production incentives. This section also reduces the quarterly minimum amount of advanced biofuels that's eligible from 23,700 million thermal units to just 1,500. So again, what we're trying to do is get the smaller facilities. Actually, I have a ethanol plant in my district that's looking to test some creative ways, and that's why I'm brought this bill forward. What Section 2 does is clarifies that an eligible advanced biofuel facility will be reimbursed at a lower rate for oil or animal fat feedstock than for cellulose biomass feedstock. And then Section 3 reduces the minimum startup level and the minimum quarterly level of renewable chemical production for reimbursements. The reduction is from 750,000 pounds to 250,000 pounds. So what we're doing is in 2015, we just didn't know what's coming down the pipeline. We have the program. What I'm trying to do with this bill is make it so our ethanol plants and maybe other ag production can utilize this program for the future. And according to the fiscal note, this bill really has no fiscal impact to the state since the current appropriation with AGRI is limited to $1.5 million a year. The administration expense for processing additional quarterly payments would be less than $1,000 a year and could be contained with their current budget is what we're estimating. So there's your Cliff Notes version because I know you have a full agenda today.
Thank you, Representative Backer. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify at support or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, are there any questions around the table, the committee members? Thank you, Representative Backer. So we will I'll renew the motion to include House File 931 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we'll move on to Representative Dabney, House File 212.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members.
Good morning, Representative Dabney. So welcome to the committee. Again, this is another bill that we're for possible inclusion that we're going to lay over, and I will move House File 212 for the author to get it before the committee. And I believe you have an amendment.
Yes, I do.
You would like the division to consider. So how about Representative Hansen? Would you like to move the amendment?
I would.
All right. So HO212A1 amendment. Would you describe the amendment?
Madam Chair, the amendment allows the Metropolitan Mosquito Control District to operate in the interest of public health in cities of the first class if we remove the preemption burden that is currently on the cities as is envisioned in the underlying bill.
All right. Are there any questions for the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
Nay.
Okay. The amendment is adopted. So I know there are a number of people who want to testify. We're going to give you the opportunity to present your bill, and then we will try to maybe go back and forth between support and opposition within the time that we have allotted. So, sure. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, last fall, friends invited us to come with them to Longfellow Gardens. Longfellow Gardens are beautiful flower gardens that are maintained by volunteers in Minnehaha Falls Park, actually Minnesota's first state park. And what we didn't know is what we found was a spectacle of nature. Longfellow Gardens is a way station for monarch butterflies on their migration south in the fall. And we came near the end of the day to find hundreds of monarchs flitting amongst these flowers. An amazing opportunity to see this. And here, just feet from Highway 55, not far as the butterfly flies, from Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, and in the middle of the state's largest city. House File 212 would remove the preemption burden on cities of the first class that was instituted several decades ago, preventing them from being able to regulate the application, use, and disposal of pesticides within the city limits. This would allow local municipalities to establish policies that reflect their local conditions, constituents, and natural areas. Pollinators are, of course, a critical concern, those that are migrating through, such as the monarchs, and also insects such as the rusty-patched bumblebee, which has lost 87% of its range in North America, is now on the endangered species list, but still calls the Twin Cities home. Obviously, protecting endangered species should be a priority over preemption. Providing these pollinators safe harbors can support the continuation of the species as well as agriculture as they move out of the cities and across these jurisdictional boundaries. Madam Chair, with me today is Aaron Roop of Pollinate Minnesota, if that would
yes.
work for you. Thank you.
Mr. Roop, and just as a reminder, we're keeping everybody testimony as brief as possible.
So 10 minutes? No, just joking. it's a joy to be here with you all. Thank you for having my testimony as part of this conversation. So I mentioned that I served on Governor Dayton's Committee for Pollinator Protection. We had the honor of being joined through webinar from somebody at the EPA. And we hear a lot about the science around pollinator exposure to pesticides, and when you're registering a pesticide, I learned through this conversation with the EPA, you test it on some surrogate species. Honeybees is the surrogate species for insects, for arthropods. Honeybees, as I mentioned in my previous testimony, are bigger than other species of bee. They're not a stand-in for other bees. They're not a stand-in for spiders. They're not a stand-in for bumblebees. Individual honeybees are not a stand-in for the colony of honeybees. Pesticides impact all of those different species and the individual versus the colony in different ways and in ways that we're learning more about, in an ongoing way. So the science continues to come in on the impact that pesticides have on our ecosystems, on our individual species, and that science is oftentimes moving quicker than the EPA responds to it, than the label responds to it. So it makes sense to me to allow cities of the first class to be able, if they choose, to author their own protections for pollinators from pesticide exposures. And I think I mentioned that I'm Aaron Roop. Thank you for allowing me to join you.
Thank you, Ms. Roop. All right. I will turn over, I think, to the next testifier. So you have no one else, Representative Dabney, is that correct?
Not at this time. If there are questions, I've got another testifier.
Sure. There are a few people. So I'm going to bring down Mike Fresvick. Is he going to be coming down or instead? Sorry, it's Stacy Johnston. So we're going to try and go back and forth between pro and con, I think. So this, I believe, so Stacy, welcome to the committee. State your name and provide some testimony, please.
Hi, I'm Stacy Johnston. I'm a board-certified entomologist. I'm certified in urban industrial entomology and veterinary medical entomology. I'm currently employed by Ecolab Pest Elimination Division and here today representing the Minnesota Pest Management Association as the current president. A few quick notes about our industry. We are 170 pest control companies in the state of Minnesota with approximately 1,000 applicators who are professionals. Each year, we get together for a day and a half required by our state Department of Agriculture to continue our education in this area. We are opposed to this bill based on the fact that the state and the federal are rich in resources in order to make the conclusions that are needed to make in a very highly complex industry. And those resources consist of chemists, scientists, entomologists, and legal resources. Our industry has received very few complaints regarding how we use pesticides and control pests in the environment. We are commonly found providing pest elimination services and pest control services in the structures, including your homes, your businesses, schools, hospitals, and food processing industries. What we are afraid of is that it will allow for misguided and unwarranted adverse impacts to both product bans and additional regulations, which most likely will have negative impacts to the public and would likely disproportionately affect low-income people as regulations raise prices and limit the number of companies willing to work in those areas. At this time, we are also concerned that retail sales of pesticides that aren't effective would be on the rise and remove the pest control professionals from the situation. It is for these reasons and many more that we have placed in our policy statement, which we have emailed to everyone on the committee, but I also have copies if you would like, that we are opposed to this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. All right, so I'm going to go to Willa Childress. If I've said your name correctly. Welcome to the committee. State your name and provide your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Willa Childress. I'm an organizer with Pesticide Action Network. I am here to voice the support of PAN's more than 2,500 members in the state of Minnesota for House File 212. I work with a lot of Minnesotans on issues around pesticides. You can bet that when somebody is having a problem, they call the Pesticide Action Network pretty early on. And I've seen that there are many regional differences when it comes to pesticide issues that people report. In greater Minnesota, it depends a lot on the geography, the weather, and the type of crop that is grown. In urban areas like the ones that would be exempted in this bill, pesticide issues have to do a lot with cosmetic use. Pesticides used for home and garden don't make up the bulk of pesticides in our state, but they are significantly more concentrated than agricultural pesticides, and they are more frequently misused. Working with farmers and beekeepers, rural and urban families across Minnesota, it is clear to me that a blanket regulatory system for pesticides just isn't working, and our preemption laws prevent communities from taking action when an issue arises. I also know that local control can be helpful for state policy, allowing us to test new legislation that state legislators may want to roll out eventually statewide, but on a smaller scale. This could increase collaboration between local and state decision makers and help us fix legislative gaps earlier for more efficient policymaking. Finally, preemption is common sense in that it puts power in the hands of local communities. We are not asking for Minnesota to be a national leader in reversing preemption, but rather follow a model that other states have worked out. Many states have both reversed or made exemptions on preemption laws, or never had pesticide preemption laws in the first place. Alaska, Maine, Nevada, Hawaii, these are just some of the few states that do not currently have preemption at all across the country. Granting four communities local control over pesticides can do a lot of good for our state. Thanks for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Dr. Stephen Kells. Welcome to the committee. State your name, please, and provide your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson. I am Dr. Stephen Kells. I am an entomologist at the University of Minnesota. My responsibility and specialty is in the fields of controlling pests in and around structures, including bedbugs, cockroaches, rats, mice, flies, carpenter ants, fleas, box elder bugs, Asian lady beetles, and ticks, and numerous others. I have also had experience with looking at and examining municipal laws when we had some sort of preemption in place. And quite often I find that the laws that are managed are not managed under a scientific risk management type perspective, but it's more of a political perspective. When we try and see newer, safer products being used in those municipalities, they're often rejected just because they come from the big corporations. And so we see sort of more toxic products, more risk products in the mix with the with these municipalities. Often with municipalities, the local politicians do not want to step on homeowners' applications and property rights. And so what they'll often do is they will target the companies to say that they've done something, but then they don't address the homeowner applications or misapplications. And quite often it's the homeowners that are causing more of the misapplications, exposures, and toxicity issues. If we look at the ability to put these laws into a city's hands, we're looking at essentially limiting the companies who are trained, and I oversee the training of 1,200 applicators for structural pest management operations in this state. Just basically say the other thing is that I'm concerned that municipalities underestimate the funding that's required to manage and to put together an effective pest management laws and regulations, and quite often they just are a mere shadow of what they should be. And I think the strength of the laws that we have at the state, the support that we have at the state, is the best way to manage the in-state application of pesticides. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kells. Okay, Margot Munson. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, yes. It turns out my cousin.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Or second cousin or one of those things that I don't
Did
quite
Did you just find that out today?
No, I've known that. I didn't know that she was coming today.
Oh, well,
so
very
good. I didn't talk to my husband.
It's always good to have family in your court, right? Okay.
Madam Chair of Committee Members, I'm Margaret Munson. I'm an entomologist, a beekeeper, and a longtime volunteer member of the Land Stewardship Project, which is a grassroots organization committed to building strong communities. Members agree that communities need strong local control, and we know from experience that rights that are not defended are often lost. When residents have a say in what happens in their community, their leaders act in the best interest of the people they serve. Members depend on each other, invest in each other's success, and in turn, more local businesses are committed. Minnesotans lost their control over pesticides in the 80s, around the time a national preemption campaign was carried out in multiple states. House File 212 is the first step in restoring local control, starting in regions where most pesticide use is cosmetic for lawns and gardens, rather than agricultural. It offers a middle ground between the urban cosmetic use and agricultural use, applies to just 4 of our largest cities, but only if they decide to create them. Minnesota and Minneapolis in the state have been concerned about pollinator decline for some time now, especially since the once very, very common rusty patch bumblebee that you could find almost in almost any situation is now very rare and has been federally listed. Bumblebees, by the way, are our most efficient pollinators of many food crops as well as all of our wild and natural habitats. Bumblebees are native. They take care of our native habitats. Many communities have unique needs and problems related to pesticides that should be addressed at a local level. Currently, mayors and city governments have their hands tied when they're faced with a problem related to pesticides. Weakening local control often happens when special interests work to undermine township rights, putting development interests ahead of the community, and then weakens the power of the city councils and the mayors. When entities move in that are not invested in the local communities, developers, for example, the local businesses struggle. So untying the hands of mayors and city governments to act when they are caught off guard by unanticipated and potentially harmful proposals is important.
especially when they're from outside interests. So please support House File 212. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And then we have, we'll have one more speaking in opposition, I believe. So either Allison Azar or Tim Powers. And I think if Allison has not yet presented, she'll be able to come forward and speak. And just because we are laying this bill over. So welcome to the committee. If you will please identify yourself and provide testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'll keep my comments brief as possible. I know we're pretty packed today. I appreciate the opportunity to come speak to you today in opposition of House File 212 regarding the elimination of state preemption for pesticide control ordinances for first-class cities in Minnesota. So the Household and Commercial Products Association, who I represent, HCPA, is the premier trade association representing the members, our members manufacture, sell, and distribute approximately $180 billion annually in household consumer products. I like to say the products underneath your kitchen sink. So in addition to most of our member products, not only include disinfectants and sanitizers that you use in your homes, hospitals, and restaurants, we also include pest management products that, again, you use in your homes, lawn care, and pets. Again, keeping my comments brief to really echo what the other members in opposition have listed, I would just like to state that pesticides sold and used in Minnesota must be registered with the U.S. EPA and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Federal law requires that before selling or distributing a pesticide in the United States, a person must obtain registration or license from the EPA. Before registering a new pesticide or a new use for a pesticide, the EPA must first ensure that the pesticide, when used according to label directions, can be used with a reasonable certainty of no harm to human health and without imposing unreasonable risk to the environment. To make such a determination, the EPA requires more than 100 different scientific studies and tests from its applicants. In addition to the extensive federal regulations and tests that pesticide products need to comply with before even coming to market in Minnesota, allowing first-class cities in the state of Minnesota to regulate pesticides would require additional resources at the local level. Localities do not have the expertise of chemists or scientists or the legal resources to effectively regulate pesticides compared to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Furthermore, this legislation undermines the robust work already being done by the experts in that field by the US EPA and the Department of Ag. For those reasons, I oppose House File 212, and thank you for letting me come speak to you today.
Thank you for your testimony. We have a question. Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, mine's for the author, so if there is
okay. Somebody. I think we will be concluding with the testifiers, and Representative Dabney will be available for questions. So, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney, listening to the testimony, there was a lot of discussion about registration, and then I'm looking at the bill, and I would encourage people to look at the bill, that the preemption of local law, what's preempted is registration, labeling, distribution, sale, handling, use, application, or disposal. And it appears your change is that you would be lifting the preemption on only three of those tasks, that you would not be asking for lifting the preemption on registration, labeling, distribution, sale, handling, but you're only looking at use, application, and disposal. Is that correct?
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I think you can think of this as a double-targeted bill. It's targeted in which parts of the state preemption it asks to lift, and it's targeted in only four cities of the first class in the state.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, so the cities of the first class, which Representative Dabney, is that over half the population of the state?
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, it's math week. You may not be aware of that. I'm going to guess the implication of the question is yes.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, you're a teacher, and I did not know the answer. I was asking you for...
Okay. All right.
But with that, Madam Chair, the point of the question is that the cities of the first class, which may be near 50%, you're only asking for use, application, and disposal for those tasks. And, Madam Chair, I think I looked up the statute, and it was passed in 1987, along with, as was referenced, many other states passed that.
And I thought, and I started at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture in 1988, that there was some discussion about delegation authority. We have the Department of Agriculture delegates certain authorities, like with food licensing, to cities to do certain tasks. And I think that might be a sweet spot in here if you're only looking for use, application, or disposal, or the ability to respond to things, that there would be a bridge here with the Department of Ag for delegation of authority where there's a contractual agreement. And I know we had a situation several years ago with a city of the first class who could not do the food inspections, and so that delegation authority was pulled back from the department. So I just want to raise that as some place in the future, but I think the discussions about testing and going through the whole evaluation of evaluating the pesticide, whether it should be produced into commerce, that does not appear to be being lifted, because registration would still be preempted under the bill that you have.
Madam Chair.
Representative Devney.
Representative Hansen raises a good point. The state's preemption of local responsibility and local decision-making was part of a wave across the country. Preemption is not a scientific conclusion. Preemption is a political decision by a legislature to remove local control from locally elected officials. This bill would simply allow for cities, if they choose, to respond to stakeholders and work out their own local ordinances.
Thank you for the clarification. We have a number of people who are on the list for questions, and we are going to keep the questions brief and the responses brief, and this bill is being laid over, so just as a reminder, Representative Brand.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Devney, just a quick question. Why first cities and not all four classes of cities?
Representative Devney.
Madam Chair, Representative Brand, thank you for the question. At this point, I represent one of the cities of the first class. I had local constituents who brought this bill to me, and I wanted to respect their leadership.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Next would be Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I'm still not quite sure the problem you're trying to fix here, but I have to say I admire what you've done with the bill. The testifiers you've had in favor of the bill mainly have talked about pollinators and pesticides, things like that. Yet your amendment exempts the organization that would, I would think, have the greatest impact on pollinators, the Mosquito Control District, exempting them from use and application of pesticides all over the metro area. So it seems to me that your intent is really impacted negatively by the amendment that we just adopted, exempting the control district from your bill. Could you just comment on that?
Representative Devney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson. I think there are a couple of pieces at play with the amendment. First of all, of course, the Mosquito Control District is operated by professionals knowing how to properly apply the pesticides they use. Not the same with home use by people like me in our lawns and yards and gardens. Secondly, there's always a balance point in public policy, and the balance point there is with public health. The question before the committee is, should the state continue to tie the hands of mayors and city councils, communities, and stakeholders on pesticides in the cities?
Representative Anderson.
Just a quick follow-up, Madam Chair. I would suggest that the Department of Ag people that work in this area are professionals as well and know what they're doing, and I'll leave it at that.
Representative Devney.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I agree they are professionals, but I would also suggest that the yard around my house and the miles around my house are very different from the yard and miles around your house, and that we should allow then local communities to have exercise their authority in regulating pesticides in their area.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. First, going back to delegated authority comment that Representative Hansen mentioned, does your bill allow for the Department of Agriculture to reach out and take this back if we have a bad experience? And now that's the way it generally works for a lot of other public health safety programs. If an agency sees that delegated authority is not being properly executed, they will unhesitantly reach out and take it back. Does your bill allow that?
Representative Daphne.
Madam Chair, Representative, in the last biennium, there were 56 bills introduced in this legislature to preempt locally elected officials' authority in a variety of areas. I'm fully confident if there is a problem with any one of the four cities not managing this return of responsibility properly, someone in this legislature will be glad to come forward with another bill to preempt them.
I guess for Madam Chair, yes, I guess that's a no, that once that basically the city is on their own, despite the Department of Agriculture. I get that. That's not a sweet way to say, nope, they got it, and the Department of Ag doesn't have oversight authority directly like they do for a delegated program. Let's just make sure we get that honestly on the table, Madam Chair. I have a second question.
Thank you, Representative Lewick. I'm just going to interrupt because Representative Daphne is supposed to be back in a different committee, apparently. So if you want to respond to Representative Lewick.
I can take the next question.
And then Representative Keel also has a question, but Representative Lewick first.
Second question would be funding this program. Would this be property tax money from the local taxpayers that would be in competition with your firemen, with your police, with your EMTs, with your ambulance service as you create this new program?
Representative Daphne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lewick. That's a decision for locally elected officials.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Daphne, I'm curious. We're talking about public health here. So what happens if this gets away and we've got major problems with getting rid of pests that could create a public health issue?
Representative Daphne.
Madam Chair and Representative Keel, just like nothing is ever dead here during the legislative session, this is an ongoing conversation. As I said, the question before the committee is whether we respect locally elected officials or whether we should continue with the political decision to preempt locally elected officials from bringing stakeholders together, including the Department of Agriculture, including the University of Minnesota, including their community, and make a decision about the use, application, or disposal of pesticides in their local communities.
All right, Representative Keel.
I just make this comment. It really concerns me that before we get to the next legislative session that we've got a public health problem that may get out of hand if we do not deal with a pest that can multiply in a very rapid hurry. And would heed the University of Minnesota, what is it, Dr. Kell's suggestions. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Daphne, I'll let you respond and then do some closing comments.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Keel, I trust our locally elected officials to be closest to that their constituents and those stakeholders and closest to problems, whether the problem be bee die-offs of beehives, as we saw in the city of Minneapolis in 2013. I was a beekeeper at that time, or concerns around public health. So it's, again, it's a question of trusting locally elected officials or not. Madam Chair, I want to thank you for the opportunity to present the bill. I do think the question is clear. It's a responsibility. The question is whose responsibility best reflects the locally elected officials, local community, and stakeholders. And with that, I appreciate the time and thank you and the committee for the opportunity.
Thank you for enlightening us and for maybe lighting us with with some lots of discussion there. So I appreciate that, Representative Daphne. Representative Brand, if you'll take over, I'm going to now move to House File 1965.
So this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. Chair Poppe, please move your bill and begin.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and just as a, so that last bill was also laid over, this is a, I move House File 1965 for possible inclusion in the omnibus ag policy bill. So I would just like to, this is an aquaculture regulatory bill, House File 1965. It provides for guidelines for transportation and importation of saltwater aquatic life. Those of us who have been around the last couple of years have heard more about this, but just to kind of familiarize everyone with it, we currently have statutes that govern transportation and importation of aquatic life, but they're more applicable to saltwater species for human food. And so the current state law does not necessarily anticipate saltwater aquaculture at the scale that it currently is at. This bill provides some of the needed regulatory framework for a new emerging saltwater aquaculture industry. And I know that we have learned about shrimp in the last couple of years, and it's surprising the number of shrimp farms throughout the state that we have a number of those. This bill has been drafted with the participation of the Department of Ag, the DNR, the MPCA, the Board of Animal Health, and with the expertise of the USDA Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. This has been done collaboratively to provide for biosecurity for the industry and to protect our native waterways and wildlife. MDA is currently and remains the license and permit coordinator for aquaculture, and DNR is and remains the one that issues licenses and permits, so there's no fiscal impact. And so just briefly to describe the bill, Section 1 defines the saltwater aquatic farms as ag operations for permits issued by the MPCA. It's technical in nature. MPCA would tell you it doesn't impact how they would issue permits. It's more important from a local zoning perspective. It is consistent as these farms are considered agricultural operations for property tax purposes. Sections 2 through 4 define saltwater aquaculture, saltwater aquatic farms, and saltwater aquatic life. Section 5 provides a regulatory framework. Right now, transportation permits are required for other types of aquatic life and are issued from the DNR. These set expectations for those permits for saltwater aquatic life. This has all been worked out with the DNR. It's important work done, again, collaboratively to provide for biosecurity for the industry and to protect our native waterways and wildlife. So essentially, there are three pathways for bringing in aquatic life from, one, a domestic facility that has been certified disease-free for 3 years, that the shipment is free of any other species. Number two, an international facility certified disease-free for 3 years, and the shipment is free of other species, with a quarantine plan approved by the commissioner. Or three, a domestic or foreign facility that the shipment itself is free of disease and other species, but the facility isn't certified for 36 consecutive months with a quarantine plan approved by the commissioner. They are using the OIE, Aquatic Animal Health Code, and the AFS Fish Book. Those serve as guides with a schedule for testing and the types of pathogens for which to test. These are standard and well-recognized in the industry, and OIE is used for other livestock. So it's trying to be consistent, and it's trying to be comprehensive, and kind of the big issue is the biosecurity for the industry and to protect our native waterways and wildlife. So that is the bill, that's what I have before you.
Chair Posse, do you have any testifiers, or would you like to take a question first?
If I need to call friends, I certainly will be doing that.
Okay. Representative Miller.
No tough questions here, I promise, today. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Madam Chair, Chair Poppy. This is really good stuff, and it's more of a quick comment. I have a shrimp business that's just a hair out of my district, but for all practical purposes in my district, and a comment of things we need to look forward. I took some quick notes of what you were saying. I heard the DNR and the MPCA, but this is members of this committee. This is an industry that, believe it or not, is really growing in Minnesota. And there's some technologies from Minnesota-based companies that are coming out that's going to expand it even more. So I think we're going to have to see more legislation like this to kind of get it in line, because saltwater aquatic life is pretty unique for Minnesota. And I just encourage you as a chair and the other committees that might be touching on this, that we're going to have to address and readdress some of the tweaks and stuff like that to make sure that they have the ability to grow this industry, because I think this is really going to be important for rural Minnesota. So thank you for this bill. And I mentioned to you once before, so this is my advertisement again. I think a committee trip out to Simply Shrimp in Blumkiss, Minnesota would be a great trip. Trust me, I went on about a two-hour tour of the place, and it was fascinating. And I think you really get a good look of what's coming ahead. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Tapke. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Madam Chair, for bringing this bill forward. I just wanted to agree with Representative Miller that I think this is really good and the beginnings of a lot of great work that can be done in Minnesota around this issue. So thank you for bringing this bill forward.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Poppe. I'm going to go on the bill to 2.17 through 2.23, and it's the purpose statement. And I know we've tried to move away from purpose statements, and I just would flag that purpose statement as I don't know if it's necessary, and I know the legislature as a practice has tried to move away from purpose statements. I applaud you for working with the various agencies and that they've come together on it, on the entire bill. I think the issue with the shrimp still gets into how do you deal with salt water in our state, and that's not in the bill. So this deals with some of the practical matters with transport and that, and I think mm-hmm. those do need to be detailed. So I'd ask you if it's really necessary to have a purpose statement in there, and I'm hopeful that the issues related to salt water will be worked out.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else? I'm sorry, Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Poppe. I did ask the question about salt water at the time that I first saw this bill. And just for comment, it is a concern, and I was told that because it is so expensive to salinate, that there would be plans in place to help reuse the water as opposed to dumping the water. So I just wanted to share that comment with the committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can actually, from my tour, I learned actually, Representative, that salt water is also very valuable and it improves over time. So they don't get rid of it. They recycle it and recycle it. So it's very contained.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Poppe, you may have touched on this, and I didn't quite hear all of it. You mentioned, talked about MPCA and their permitting, and now they have to recognize these as ag operations as they relate to, I underlined here, discharge. Now, going back to the true shrimp situation, would this have any impact on the conductivity of their water, or you said this is more about a permitting, zoning type thing, but would it at all affect a situation like that?
Thank you, Representative Anderson and Mr. It will not impact anything. I'm looking to my call-a-friend friends, and they're saying no.
Nobody else in the committee that wishes to ask a question. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay, seeing no one. Chair Poppe, any closing statements before I lay this over? Awesome conclusion.
Thanks for the opportunity to have the bill heard. Thank you.
Okay. This bill is now laid over.
All right, members, thank you. We are now back to kind of one of the reasons why we are together as a committee, which is policy, and having a policy bill. And so what we have, we were able to post the DE amendment. We're using the core bill, which is the bill from the department, 1733. But what we're going to talk about today is the amendment, which is the DE amendment. So I'm going to just move House File 1733 to get the bill before us. But what we're going to hear is the what's included in the DE 2 amendment, and then we will allow you the opportunity, anyone the opportunity, to bring forth amendments so that Thursday we'll actually have the bill before us and any amendments from committee members. So if that is clear enough for everyone, I will ask Mr. Sullivan to walk us through the DE2 amendment so everyone has that in their packet. So, Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and members, I'll do a walkthrough of the DE2. Mr. Chesseth with the Department of Agriculture presented the provisions in House File 1733 as introduced to the committee on February 28th. So I won't go into detail on the sections that are the same, but we'll spend most of my time here flagging the changes or the differences from the bill as introduced. So starting on page one, members will notice that the provisions pertaining to the Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council are not in the DE. So the first section is pertains to the storage of bald and burlapped nursery stock. Section two, the House File 1733 as introduced also proposed to change the existing statutory definition of industrial hemp, including the language that you'll see on lines 1.16, 1.17, and 1.18. But this language is a bit different and is actually the same as in Representative Vang's House File 1660, and the difference is on line 1.15. You'll note that there's no change to that line, so it retains the current restriction legalizing industrial hemp, that is the species Cannabis sativa L. The House File 1733 as introduced would have expanded the definition of industrial hemp to include any species of the genus Cannabis. So that's a difference of note on the bottom of page one. Moving on to page two, we begin a series of sections that are exactly the same as in House File 1733 pertaining to expedited rulemaking authority for industrial hemp, the definition of drug for purposes of commercial feed law, and then a series of sections beginning with section 5 on the bottom of page 2, creating a new custom-exempt food handler license. And those continue for several pages of the DE all the way through the top of page 9. And then the next section, section 11, is also from the bill as introduced, and it pertains to shelf life standards for eggs. Section 12 was not in the bill as introduced. Members will recognize this, though, as Representative Lippert's House File 1267, which extends the existing Minnesota Organic Advisory Task Force for an additional 5 years. That continues to the top, page 11, where Section 13 was in the bill as introduced, milk storage requirements for dairy farms. Section 14 was in the bill as introduced, milk labeling standards modified. Section 15 on the bottom of page 11 was in the bill as introduced, as were section 16 on page 12, and then the beginning of the advanced biofuel. Members heard proposed changes to the bioeconomy incentive programs today, advanced biofuel, renewable chemical, and biomass thermal. But the language that begins on page 12, section 17, these are all the changes that were proposed by the department in House File 1733. So those continue through pages 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17. The next section, section 28, begins a series of sections that modify loan programs administered by the Rural Finance Authority. Section 28 was in the bill as introduced and would expand the livestock expansion loan program to allow loans for the purchase of livestock farms. Section 29 on the top of page 18 was in the bill as introduced, and it modifies the education requirements for farmers who are participating in the Rural Finance Authority's Beginning Farmer Loan Program. And then on the bottom of page 18, section 30 makes comparable changes to another program administered or certified by the Rural Finance Authority, and that's the Beginning Farmer Income Tax Credit programs. You see on the bottom of page 19, comparable changes to provide additional flexibility for certifying beginning farmers who satisfy education requirements and are eligible for the tax credit. And then, by extension, the existing farmers who sell or rent land to that farmer would be eligible as well. Then, let's see, that continues on top of page 20, tax credit. See the effective date that's applicable to the tax change on line 20.22 to 20.23. The next sections that have to do with the disaster recovery loan program, that's sections 31 and 32 were in the bill as introduced. Section 33 is a bit different. This is sections 33 and 34 are language that members will recognize from Representative Anderson's House File 270, changing the methane digester loan program administered by the Rural Finance Authority. In House File 1733, as introduced, the department also proposed to change this program to allow a borrower to receive more than one methane digester loan program. Representative Anderson's bill goes a bit further in that it allows that loan the second loan to be used for improvement of an existing system. I guess it would allow a first loan for that purpose as well, but it allows the program, the loans to be used to improve an existing digester, not just to construct a new one as under current law. And then section 34 says that a borrower may receive more than one loan, but only if the first loan has been repaid in full. Then the sections 35 and 36 are from the bill as introduced and expand the loan amount for existing RFA loan programs. Section 37 on page 23 was not in the bill as introduced. This is Representative Schomacher's House File 820, specifying that basins used to hold wastewater from livestock truck washing facilities are not open-air swine basins. Prohibited open-air swine basins. And then the repealers the same. These are two existing definitions under the bioeconomy programs that would be replaced essentially by the general term biomass in the bill. And that's the end of the DE, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Are there questions from committee members? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you for your indulgence, Madam Chair. On page one of the DE, line 17, I still have an issue with extracts being labeled as being industrial hemp. And it just concerns me that we've been told extracts could include the THC. And I'm not quite sure yet we're to the point where we know how to handle that. When they go into extracting the CBD oil to get the components they want. So that word there does concern me, and I'd like to see it changed or removed or whatever. That could be an amendment, so thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Savory might want to just, because some things that aren't in this bill may be in a finance bill because they had some fiscal impacts. So, Representative Savory, I don't know if you had any comments about the policy bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would say in consultation with Mr. Sullivan and the department, reached on several provisions, and I believe that this bill is constructed, the DE as constructed, does not contain any fiscal material that would raise an issue at this time.
Thank you. All right. Anybody else have questions about this? As I've mentioned, we will be, if people have amendments, they can prepare those and have those to the committee by 9:45 tomorrow morning, and then we will put the bill together on Thursday. So seeing no other questions, okay. But we do have the opportunity for public testimony because the bill is before us, and then the amendment is what we walk through. Is there anyone from the audience that would like to testify on this bill? And so we'll bring down people from the department. welcome to the committee. So to Deputy Commissioner Vogel and Assistant Commissioner Tesseth, if you'll welcome to the committee, provide your name and your testimony.
Thank you so much. Good morning. My name is Andrea Vowell. I serve as Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And you actually gave him a little bit of promotion. This is just our Government Affairs Director.
Oh,
he's not
I'm
an Assistant
sorry.
Commissioner yet.
Sorry about that.
No.
I thank you, Madam Chair.
I just wanted to come up here today and talk about our policy bill and the process that we go through to get these bills ready. You know, we have a number of folks that work at the department. You've probably heard me talk about them before, and you've seen them testify here a number of times. A number of them are here today. And I would say that they're the people who are on the front lines with implementing and administering the programs that you all in the legislature ask us to implement. And you give us statutory authority that we take very, very seriously. And so when our folks come to us and say, here are some things policy-wise that can make government work better, that can make things work easier for us, that can make things more inclusive and more transparent to the public that we serve, we take it very seriously. We put a lot of thought into what we put into these bills. Many times these things are coming to us year after year after year, and we vet them very carefully. And so for me personally, it's really important for us to do the great work we already do, but for us to be able to do it better. And so we don't come to you with these things lightly. We take these things very seriously. We don't bring them just because we work really hard to make sure that we bring you something that's valuable and effective and can help us serve Minnesotans in the best way that we can. And again, we have great people who work really hard to make sure that we follow the law and that we protect the public and serve them the best the way that we can. So I just wanted to reiterate that this is something that personally I take a lot of stock in that I really feel strongly about. And so I hope that you all on the committee feel the same and can help us do our jobs better as representatives of the state. So thank you very much for hearing the bill. And for listening to what we need and what we have to say.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Mr. Tesseth, did you want to provide any testimony?
Madam Chair, members, I would just second what Deputy Commissioner Vogel just said. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair, I did want to just touch on what Representative Anderson asked about the extracts and the definition. That's an excellent question. I think what we're trying to get with that is to get the definition in state law in line with the federal farm bill that makes things easier for us to implement as we hear more from USDA about how we need to implement commercial production of industrial hemp. I would also say for the extract piece, the THC you don't have to worry about because in order for it to be industrial hemp, it has to be below that 0.3% threshold. But the CBD issue, certainly we're taking a look at. We take that very seriously in terms of the regulatory framework that needs to be in place. And so we're working with a number of other agencies to make sure that there's something in place to protect consumers, to make sure that they're consuming things that are safe and made under sanitary conditions. So certainly we're looking at that, but I think it's a valid concern, but it helps us be in line with the federal farm bill to implement the program easier.
Thank you. And Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for that, Deputy Commissioner. And I think there's so much interest in this program, and we hear numbers like $90,000 an acre gross profit, things like that. And I just don't want it to become the Wild West and want to keep it regulated. And your words sound like you understand that what could be happening here. And mm-hmm. I thank you for that, and I would encourage that we do it right, do it correctly, and keep it going and keep it growing and just do it right.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. All right. So is there anyone else from the audience who would like to testify for or against the amendment? And if you'll just remain, Ms. Vogel, because I think we will go to another bill here. But any other testifiers? All right. I just want to make a note. AFRIC was one of the things that we could have included here, but there's a fiscal note, I believe, to that. So that's for possible inclusion in the finance bill. So I think We've been trying to be very deliberate in what we were including here and what we were including there. So, all right. I see no other comments or questions. So with that, I'm going to lay over House File 1733. Just a reminder, tomorrow morning, Ms. Conley will be accepting all of the amendments before 9:45. So thank you. And then we have one more bill that we have before us. So House File 2093, this is the Farmer Disaster Recovery Loan Program, and that is part of the DE2, but we're also pulling that out and sending that separately so it could go to the General Register. The reason is we are I've toured some dairy farms in the last couple of weeks, and I know that maybe others have either toured some or are aware of some. We have, on top of everything else, quite literally, people have had roofs collapse, and that has damaged their ability to continue to keep their herds. It has adjusted for them how they're doing their operations, made for some additional stress. So what we're trying to figure out are maybe some other paths. We talked about other dairy bills in this committee, and we'll continue to hopefully bring forward other things. But House File 2093 gives the Rural Finance Authority greater latitude on when to declare a disaster for the purposes of the Disaster Recovery Loan Program. And that it does not currently include the snow situation that we had. And it also requires that the governor declare an emergency, and so this would allow the authority to do that. So I just want to be able to move House File 2093, that it be recommended to be placed on the General Register. And I wanted Deputy Commissioner Vauvel up here to be able to provide some additional testimony and clarification about that bill. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Chair mentioned, you've probably heard about a number of dairies, not only just dairies, but we're hearing about hog barns and turkey barns as well, with the significant level of snow being on roofs all over the state. We're hearing about a lot of folks who are experiencing quite tragic circumstances. They're having to, you know, they're losing livestock. They're a lot of the insurance is not totally covering all of their barns. As you know, the depreciation is not covered. There's a gap there. We do have our disaster recovery loan program. However, as Chair Poppy said, it's tied to a county or state. Tied to a state or federal disaster declaration, which is generally tied to public infrastructure, which obviously this is not public infrastructure, but certainly I think the spirit is we want to provide help and loan assistance to those who are suffering, particularly in the agricultural community. So this would just allow the board of the RFA to unlock those funds. So they would meet and discuss the issues that are before them, particularly around the weather and determine whether or not we could unlock those funds. We're asking this to be moved quickly because we have heard from a number of folks. I was just out on in Altura with Chair Poppy and a number of others on Saturday talking to families who have experienced quite a bit of loss, and this would be helpful for them to just get over that hump and continue on their operations. So it would be really helpful if we could unlock those funds as soon as possible. It's a zero interest loan, and it is up to $200,000. Some of these folks, as you know, these days, you know, you're looking at millions of dollars, but every little bit helps. And so we're just hopeful that we can get this moving and unlock those funds for people as soon as possible.
Thank you for that. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question's on line 1.20 and 1.21, replacing. So I understand the storm damage and the snow. I'm seeing that this would be used for loss of revenue due to a confirmed presence of a highly contagious disease in a livestock operation. And since farm survey are considered livestock, so would this be providing a low-interest loan for loss of revenue to a whitetail deer farm where they had the detection of chronic waste and disease?
Deputy Commissioner Vauvel.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that's a great question. On the face of it, I think that that would be an eligible expense under this law, but I will confirm that with our RFA staff.
And I believe you said an eligible, not ineligible.
Yes, an eligible. Okay. Yes.
Just and to clarify, Representative Hansen.
I'll try to be clearer in the microphone.
I just wanted to clarify it.
I think we should have a quick response, and I'm willing to move things quickly for snow damage, and that I have a little heartburn over loss of revenue for a captive survey where there's CWD.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. And I'm sorry I skipped over Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will make this really quick. That this program is and has been used, is there any place where I can go, or can you send to the committee, I'm not sure which is the best, for how this has been utilized in the past, just so I understand the program better and how it works? Because we have, like, our home farm in Iowa, we had an F5 tornado take out every single building, killed a ton of animals, took out the house, the whole shebang, and had, there was zero assistance with anything. It was all covered by insurance, and so I'm trying to figure out where that balance is between state's responsibility and insurance responsibility and how we do that. So I'd just like to see how this has been utilized in the past. I'm not by any means saying I'm not highly empathetic and toward the farmers that have been greatly injured by snow damage. I just don't know where the state's responsibility lies, and I'd like to learn how this has been, what precedent has been set. So thank you.
And Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Tapke, we can certainly provide you with that information. I would say, again, it does only apply to things that are not covered by insurance. So we'll be sure to get you that information.
Thank you.
And thank you for that. Just, you know, one other point that this also, there's a retroactive date back to January 1, 2019, so that we're trying to take care of things that have happened already. So, Representative Cleburne.
I just lost my microphone. For clarification, Madam Chair, when you say not covered by insurance, you're saying an insurance plan was in place and this was an exemption. It's not that they didn't ever purchase insurance for the barn.
Madam Chair, Representative Cleburne, so these folks have insurance for the most part. A lot of times it's valued at a certain level when they build it or when it's first valued, and some of these barns are from, you know, the 1970s, and so it depreciates, and so it's not covered fully. So that's where the gap exists.
Okay. May I ask one more? With reference to the farm survey, if we are considering it livestock, and it would be considered in here, would we, is there a limit to the size of a herd, a limit to the size of a flock, or is it just however many birds or deer or cattle?
The limit is to the size of the amount.
Of the
amount? But, Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Poppy, Representative Cleburne, I think how we came to it was it's dependent upon your the income limit is how these are determined in terms of the RFA loans.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, looking at the whole bill, the parts that are stricken relating to damage, high winds and hail, that would allow for the snow damage. Section 5 or number 5 isn't related to snow damage. It's only related to the disease. It has nothing to do with snow damage. It says replace livestock, make building improvements, cover lost revenue, and or replacements is due to the so the only relevant section in 5 is due to the confirmed presence of a disease, not to any storm damage or emergency. It is only chronic waste and disease, and I don't think that's right. I think if we're going to be responding to the storm damage, we should be doing the storm damage and not sending this to the general register on whether we're going to subsidize these facilities.
Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Poppe, Representative Hansen. So the reason that is in there is most of this language is already in our policy bill, and so we just took that section out so that we could move it along. Part of the reason we added that were there are a number of foreign animal diseases that are on the horizon, particularly one we're thinking of is African swine fever. And so the language that was called out beforehand was just applicable to avian influenza, and so we wanted to make sure that we covered other livestock diseases that could come to Minnesota. So I'm sorry I did not touch on that when we described it, but it's part of the bill because that was already in the policy bill beforehand. So it's just part of that section.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Representative Wasilewicz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noted just in that section that Representative Hansen was referring to, it says the confirmed presence. I'm just wondering if you can clarify who or what entity would be confirming the presence.
Chair Poppe, Representative, that's a great question. Generally how that happens is there's some testing that takes place. So with HPAI, highly pathogenic avian influenza, we took samples and they were tested at the veterinary diagnostic lab. So we just make sure that it's scientifically confirmed that the presence of that disease is there.
Okay.
Representative Cleavon.
Sorry. Okay, so you just, forgive me, Madam Chair,
mm-hmm.
Deputy Commissioner, you just spoke in the past tense, which makes me think that you have a specific farm in mind for this particular paragraph. You said we did test, we have. Is there a specific farm that this has been written for, or is it really general policy?
Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Poppe, Representative Cleavon. This is general policy. So what I was referring to was in 2015, there was a breakout of highly pathogenic avian influenza where we lost millions of birds.
Right.
And so I was just referring to an example that when it was first confirmed in 2015, that's how we confirmed that it existed there.
Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. After hearing Representative Hansen talking about lines 110 and 111, I see the word flood is stricken, and with heavy rain possible and snow melt, may it be wise to leave that word in here? Farmer may have a feed pile that gets inundated and have that damaged and lost. So just a suggestion to maybe leave the word flood in the bill.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Poppe, Representative Anderson, and maybe Colby can clarify this, but I think we just decided to take all of those out just because then it was sort of it did include everything. And so the language still reads that the authority can still say whether it's flood or high winds or snow, they can deem something an emergency. So it doesn't make it too inclusive, I suppose, mm-hmm. is
Mr. Sullivan, I don't know if you want to help to provide some clarity.
Madam Chair and members, that's my understanding as well. This language was drafted by the Reviser of Statutes Office, but my understanding is, as Ms. Bobble stated, the language on lines 1.110 and 1.111, eliminating those specific categories of storm or disaster, is intended to broaden it to all forms of natural disaster or other disaster, and that, I believe, is supposed to work in conjunction with the language on 2.6 and 2.7 that allows the RFA to declare a market disaster or emergency. So in this case, I think they would declare an emergency related to the excessive snowfall.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, and I don't want to carve up the chair's bill here, but the bill doesn't, so if we strike on 110 and 111, we're actually striking anything related to disaster, and it just becomes a payment program that says we shall establish and implement a disaster recovery program, and then it provides the ability to the authority to determine it. And we have elsewhere, I think Representative Pawlowski has the disaster repayment program for things where there are definitions of disaster, and I would think it would be good to actually have a section that talks about disasters that mentions, rather than eliminating it where there is something that could be
left out to be descriptive that you are having floods, tornadoes, high winds, hail, snow damage, those type of things, so there's direction to the authority rather than giving the authority carte blanche. And then I understand with the potential of diseases coming, but the 119, 120, and 121 has nothing to do with barn damage, and that maybe that's in the policy bill, a discussion on that. But, Madam Chair, is this going to the General Register directly from here?
It would be.
And, Madam Chair, is there any fiscal note?
Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Poppe, Representative Hansen, no. It's a revolving loan fund that we access, and there's funds already available there.
Representative Wasserweck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deputy Commissioner, I'm wondering if you can speak to a couple of questions. Does the RFA have any of this authority to declare these things now? And then a follow-up would be, I'm wondering what that process would look like. Like, would it be a county, the whole state? Like, I'm just curious about how that process works, because we know how federal and state do, but that's kind of unclear to me.
Deputy Commissioner.
Representative Poppe, generally, I think these, just to be clear, this would just be to unlock these funds. So they wouldn't be declaring an emergency, you know, for any other purposes. And generally what we would do is we would call a board meeting. So we try and meet almost monthly. And so we would call a board meeting, describe the situation, provide them updates on the damage that's taken place and who's affected. Sometimes it's just a certain area, so it might be a couple of counties. Sometimes it might be a statewide emergency. So I think we would just take it a case-by-case basis and talk through the damage that's taken place.
I believe we have the Director of Homeland Services here if you want to come up. There you are. To provide any further clarification as well on disaster recovery. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, good morning. For the record, my name is Joe Kelly, and I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions or to provide some clarification.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Kelly. And I think there was a question, maybe it was back a couple of questions ago, just about the current disaster recovery kind of section that we have and the money that we have for that. This is separate from that, but I don't know if you want to give us a brief just understanding about that.
Madam Chair and members, yes, thank you. I think the issue that the Department of Agriculture is working through is currently their loan programs require otherwise, a declaration of a disaster by the governor of the state of Minnesota or the president of the United States. And as was been pointed out earlier, those are tied almost exclusively to certain thresholds, amounts of damage to public infrastructure and other costs sustained by local units of government. In this case, we haven't received any information from counties across Minnesota from the blizzard of a couple weeks ago that there is the required amount of damage that would trigger, if you will, that would authorize either the governor or the president to declare a disaster. You know, therefore, the private property and business issues can't be addressed because they're tied to that public infrastructure. So I don't anticipate that there will be a disaster declaration associated with these storms that are of the subject of this discussion today.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Do you think that, I don't know if you even looked at House File 2093, but this is for the RFA, who has a disaster recovery loan program. Is there any necessity for us to include like 12B, or a reference to Chapter 12B in this bill?
Madam Chair, I don't believe so, because again, the statutes in question address very different issues.
Thank you, Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, maybe our representative from the Department of Agriculture. Can you explain the committee, that board that oversees the RFA, who all is on there, and how are they interwoven into the industry and sort of boots on the ground to identify an issue that may not be picked up, for example, like the government-related infrastructure damage that a flood might do?
Mm-hmm. Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Poppe, Representative Lewick, that's a great question. There was an iteration of the bill a few years ago, I think, that had the commissioner decide whether something was considered an emergency to unlock these funds, and we thought it was more appropriate to allow the board or the authority to determine that, simply because there are a number of voices on that committee that can help us navigate that a little better. The chair is the commissioner of agriculture. Then you also have the state auditor who is on the board. You have representatives from the lending community, so we have a number of lenders that we work with on the RFA loan program, so they bring a good perspective there. We have folks from a number of the general farm organizations. We have someone from the Central Minnesota Young Farmers Coalition. We've got folks from who are just farmers. So we have a broad perspective of folks coming to the table to help us make that determination, not just on this, but a number of RFA issues.
Just a general comment. My experience, just watching that group from a distance, is they're very parochial about making sure that they put those dollars out there only where they're needed. They watch that very closely, sort of kind of like the local bank folks on the board watch the loan officers. So, I mean, I'm perfectly comfortable with that board. Actually having that level of oversight, because my experience, again, is that they're very frugal, and you better have a need or you're not going to get the loan.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know time is of the essence here, but sure. Mr. Kelly, just kind of a what-if question. You said that the snow a couple of weeks ago causing the roof damage would not in itself be enough for a disaster declaration, but what if in 2 weeks when that snow melts and causes severe infrastructure damage and a disaster is declared, could that go back then to the roof damage caused to private structures, and could that be included in any public disaster declaration?
Mr. Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I don't believe so, because the damage to public infrastructure isn't caused by the snowfall. That's not the precipitating event, not to use the word precipitation, but that the damage caused by the snow when it melts and the associated flooding would be the determination of what caused the damage. So I don't believe that you could make that connection back to private infrastructure for flood damage following the snow event.
Representative Anderson.
I would just say it's the same snow.
In different forms. Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm kind of confused as to what Representative Hansen was talking about with the contagious diseases piece. That section, that 5.119 through 121 down there, that would only generally occur correctly if there's depopulation of a farm. Is that the main use of that with a highly contagious disease, is that what we're intending? So, or is that, am I misunderstanding what that's being used for?
Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Poppe, Representative Tabke, certainly I think that's probably the main usage. I would have to consult with our RFA team just to see if there was other things, particularly with avian influenza, that maybe they used as an applicable use. So I can't think of anything else right now, but DPOP I think would certainly be an eligible use.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Lewis.
And I would suggest you check with the Board of Animal Health, because you can literally overnight lose your state's certification for a variety of disease-free reportable diseases, and that will absolutely destroy your live animal market. I mean, you will not be able to move an animal out of the state. So that's a hugely important piece, and we found that out when we lost our TB-free status for 5 years in Minnesota.
Chair Poppy, Representative Lewick, that's a good point, too. Frequently, we have to shut down export markets and trade markets, so that's also a loss of revenue. Even if you don't have to kill the animal, you're not able to sell it.
Deputy Commissioner, so the bill that we have, 2093, was pulled out of the policy bill and to cover maybe more things than what we're talking about when we're talking about the roofs collapsing. If we were to remove 1.19 to 1.21 from House File 2093, is that critical to this bill, or would that be a something to do to be able to take care of that?
Chair Poppy, we'd be absolutely comfortable with that. I don't think that would affect our ability to unlock the disaster fund, so we're happy to just leave that in the policy bill and have a discussion later about that.
Thank you. I'm sensing that that's an issue that maybe people are somewhat concerned about at this point. And to move the bill to the general register, I guess I'm just wondering if I were to do that, I don't have Representative Hamilton. Usually I would confer with him about doing an amendment here, but I'll look to my colleagues. Are people comfortable if we were to remove Section 5, actually, on page 1 here? Is that something?
It would be Section 1. Section
1, Subdivision 5, yeah. Subdivision Clause 5. Representative Anderson?
Madam Chair, yeah, I think we need to move the bill along for its intended purpose, which is to help the storm damage. And if this would help take away any confusion, I would support that, yeah.
Okay. And Mr. Sullivan, can you just report that and then for clarity?
Yes, Madam Chair, the amendment will delete the language on 1.19 to 1.21. There are a couple of other small conforming changes. So the amendment would be page 1, line 14, reinstate the stricken language. Page 1, line 18, reinstate the stricken language and delete the new language. Page 1, delete lines 19 to 21.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Is that clear to everyone? And, okay, so then I will, can I incorporate or does that, that's an amendment that needs to be voted on. Okay, so I'm going to move that. We do as Mr. Sullivan described. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed, nay?
Nay.
Motion prevails, and we will move that in that manner then. So this is the bill then before us without that information included. Any other discussion? Okay. So what we're doing is I'd like to renew my motion that House File 2093 as amended be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the bill will be passed along. Just a reminder again, 9:45 tomorrow if you have amendments. Maybe we've stirred up some new ones. We encourage you to get those to Ms. Conley by tomorrow morning. And thank you for allowing us to have the extended time today, and with that, meeting adjourned.